As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Gilles Moet joins us now. He does come on TV. The chief economist at AXA Investment Managers. He comes to New York too. Gilles, it's great to catch up, sir, as always. There is a view, Gilles, that things are better in Europe. And I'd love a reality check from you. How much better are they relative to what we feared late in the summer?
Not much better. I don't think things have changed materially. I mean, what we knew on the energy side, for instance, was that Germany, which is, you know, the biggest potential victim of the end of Russian gas supply, that Germany had managed to get its consumption of gas significantly down, actually, in the summer, which means that their inventory position is better than what we could have feared maybe 6 months ago. But again, we knew that already at the end of the summer. Nothing has changed from that side. On the data flow in general, on you know, the fact that we are sliding into recession, all the data flow we've had still goes in the same direction. I mean, if you look at the European Commission surveys, if you look at the messages we get for the bank lending survey, for instance, it is consistent with a slide into recession within the next, you know, 3 to 6 months. So that's not really changed. What has changed is that, you know, you alluded to this, there was this one lower than expected, you know, print for inflation in the US. Market scrambles, you know, depricing what it expects on the Fed. The expected rate differential for the next 6 months between the ECB and the Fed shrinks, and you know, voila, you've got a euro rebound. I would not read much more than that, actually, into the rebound of the euro. For me, it's an interest rate differential play. That's it.
So, Gilles, walk us through your assessment of the inflation backdrop right now and how you think this bleeds into 2023.
Well, you know, I know it, especially 2-3 months ago, it was very unpopular to still use the word transitory because it was a very persistent form of transitory. But it's what we were expecting, that we would see some deceleration in inflation towards the end of 22 and into 2023. The question is how quickly we will get closer to the kind of target as central banks are pursuing. And that's a different question from the fact that it is probably already starting to decelerate. So in the US, you know, it's definitely a labor market issue. And for now, let's say that the data is ambiguous. Our contention is that we will see a slowdown in wages, and that will help take core inflation down by the second half of 2023, even if the first month of next year is going to be tough. But it's a sort of, you know, traditional, usual macroeconomic behavior. I mean, you've had a very, very tense labor market needs to soften, wages go down, inflation go down. In Europe, it's much more complicated because you still have a very, very significant share of our inflation, which is completely exogenous, which is completely driven by external factors, the depreciation in the euro that we've had until very, very recently, and gas prices, which remain extraordinarily volatile. We also expect a slowdown in inflation next year in Europe, based on mechanical behaviors, the fact that, you know, base effects should play in the wrong, in the right direction in 2023. But it's much harder to assess simply because it is not the usual traditional behavior of macroeconomic patterns. We are completely dependent on where gas prices are going to be in 6 months' time, and you know, we've been disappointed before. But on the basis of what we know right now, on the basis of forward gas prices, for instance, we should see a deceleration in inflation in 23 as well in Europe.
So, Gilles, just to sort of put that all together, are you basically saying you're willing to push against the stagflation case in the United States, but that Europe looks much more likely to be mired in stagflationary types of environments for a longer period of time?
Yeah, for me, a key difference between the US and Europe is that to some extent, the US, especially the Fed, is to a large extent in control of the situation. If the economy tanks in 2023, and normally, you know, inflation goes down, you know, more harshly than what the market is currently expecting, then, you know, the Fed can actually slow down its pace of tightening, can even cut rates. So there's a measure of control, if you want, on the state of the economy in the US. In Europe, we don't have that level of control because it is not in our hands. And for all the activism of the ECB, the fact that it's talking a lot, that it's acting, it is normalizing its monetary policy, truth is, and they've acknowledged it themselves, they have very, very little impact, and they know it, on inflation in 23 in Europe. So yes, on the basis of the balance of risks, we have more downside risks in Europe than in the US, I think, or to be more precise, we have less capacity in Europe to get us out of a recession in 23. And that, I think, should remain reflected in our exchange rate. And for now, we have this sort of knee-jerk reaction to this lone October inflation print in the US. I hope it continues, but we've had accidents before. But fundamentally, the problem is that, you know, Europe doesn't look as in control.
It just makes me wonder, when you're doing your year ahead outlook, if you basically have a meteorologist there, several of them showing you satellite pictures of what the weather is going to be like and what the trends are of El Nino or La Nina, just in general, to get a better sense. Gilles, you're saying that there isn't much that Europe can do. Is there anything that you are looking for, maybe not this year, but next year, to determine whether they've gotten a little bit more control over the energy situation so that they're not just susceptible to the next LNG import?
There's one, LNG imports is still the key, in the sense that what we need to see in 23 is the emergence of LNG importing capacity in Germany. Now, as you know, at the moment, you have LNG importing capacity in Italy, in France, in Belgium, et cetera, et cetera. You don't have it in Germany. They have a project to have a terminal coming out in 2023. That needs to come out. We need to have this LNG capacity in Germany to make sure that 23, 24 is not going to be a replication of what we're going through right now. So that would be definitely a positive. Another point, which is probably less discussed, is the capacity of the French nuclear power generation to really reach its potential in 23. That adds actually to the difficulties we have right now. As you know, you've got lots of nuclear power stations in France which have not restarted. There's a plan to restart them gradually over the next few months. We need to see that plan complete by the end of this winter. Again, to give us a measure of comfort in terms of electricity generation for 23. So that is less discussed, but I think it's almost as important.
Gilles, wonderful to hear from you, sir. A bit of a reality check around the European story from Gilles Mowak there of AXA Investment Managers. Joining us now is Linda Dussel, Senior Equity Strategist of Federated Hermes. Linda, I'll make it simple for you. Do you want to chase this rally?
No, we at Federated Hermes do not want to chase this rally. This was a predictable rally, and we've been bouncing up and down all year long, pretty much in two-month increments, if you remember the June low, and then bounced up for a couple of months later, and then bounced right back down. And what we saw last week with that great day, I think it was on Thursday, we saw money flowing into tech stocks. to an outsized degree. So there's still a lot of money out there sloshing about, looking for where to invest. And, you know, I travel all the time in my job. The most common question in the last 3 months was, what should I buy now? There is not the fear out there. So as much as 100% of people thought we're going to have a recession next year, maybe 100% of people thought you need to buy into this rally.
We've seen a lot of cuts from big tech. Meta, 11,000. Twitter, potentially half the workforce is set to go. The reports from the New York Times on Amazon yesterday, the week before it was the Journal talking about a cost-cutting review under Andy Jassy. Does that bring you confidence, Linda, about these tech companies making the required cuts, removing the excess that they've built up?
Well, yes. And of course, that's where the big increases were during the COVID shutdown, were in the tech stocks. Hundreds of thousands, I think, added onto Amazon. So, of course, they're going to cut. What we're watching is this the beginning of, you know, is this the tip of an iceberg in terms of layoffs? And of course, we think layoffs will increase next year. But what I expect will happen in 2023 is really a slow motion realization that we are going into a recession and that earnings are going to come off. And as much as we're talking in these last couple of weeks about lots of issues, there's not a lot of talk in our view at Federated Hermes about what is likely to happen to earnings estimates coming down in through next year. But it will be slow motion because of all the cash out there.
Linda, which sector of the market right now do you think is most overpriced based on the expectation that you put out there of downgrades to earning estimates next year?
Well, you know, the most expensive sector out there right now, if you look at forward PEs versus like 30 years of history, is actually utilities, because people just poured into utilities. And that's not because of people getting earnings wrong. It's because people massively going into the defensive sector. Indeed, what happened in these last few months was that the tech sector, which was the most expensive sector all year long, and pockets still are very expensive, other pockets not as much, was really brought down to earth a lot. So people feel comfortable in getting back in. So it's really a motion moving all back and forth right now. It's that one sector, utilities, that was really overbought, that's coming back down now. But in general, those high quality dividend sectors are inexpensive versus history. And that's where we're focused at Federated Hermes.
That's where you're focused in order to buy or in order to sell, Linda. Do you look at that area as accurately pricing in stagflation that other areas of the market perhaps are not?
No, we're looking to buy. Okay. We're looking to buy the defensive sectors. We're looking for income. Cash is king, that sort of an idea. Remembering to remain defensive. In fact, when you go into recession, if we really think you're going into recession, cyclicals historically underperform the defensive by about 22% so far, only 7%. Earnings estimates only down 4% now from the peak in June for this entire market. And it's likely to go down, we think, 10% anyway. So we're staying defensive here, and we're selling what looks expensive into this rally, and that is some tech for sure, some tech.
Linda, wonderful to hear from you. It always is. Linda Dussel there of Federated Hermes.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
But head down to Washington, D.C., and just a warning going into this conversation, there's a lot of noise behind Andy Barr, the Republican from Kentucky and ranking member of the House Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations. Congressman, you and I were joking in the commercial break. It's the chaos of Washington. If the chaos of Washington returns and that noise comes back, I'll let you go, sir, for sure. You made easy work of Kentucky's 6th Congressional District. Other Republicans struggled. Let's start there. Congressman, what went wrong with the party at these midterms?
Well, I'm an optimist. I'm a bit of a positive attitude. And so however you cut it, and no doubt Republicans are disappointed that the red wave did not materialize. But however you cut it, we made material gains in the House, and it looks like we're on track to taking the majority. In fact, some media outlets have already said we have, in fact, taken the majority. That was the principal objective, even not taking the Senate. What does that mean? It means that they don't give out small, medium, and large-sized gavels. They just give out gavels. And by retiring Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House, by having a new speaker, by having Republicans in charge of the gavels and the committees, it means we set the agenda. We have the ability to exercise oversight. We can put the brakes on the overspending and the threat of higher taxes, and we can exercise oversight over the regulatory assault on the free enterprise system. That's what the market should take encouragement by in this election, is that we do have divided government, even though it's going to be a thin majority.
So who would you like to see be the leader of the House of Representatives? Is it Kevin McCarthy? Who would you like to see to be the leader of the Republican Party? Is it former President Trump?
No, it's Kevin McCarthy. Kevin McCarthy. There, no one has done more for the House Republican Conference than Kevin McCarthy in terms of raising money, helping recruit candidates, helping members represent their districts, moving their legislation, assisting them, understanding their districts. So Kevin McCarthy is going to have the votes not only to win his leadership election today, but also become speaker. Now, look, there's competition. And the great thing about the Republican Party, both in these leadership elections in Congress and I anticipate in 2024, is there will be competition. There is no coronation in the Republican Party. That's the great thing about the Republican Party. We are not an authoritarian party. We are a libertarian party. We believe in free enterprise. We believe in competition and choice. We don't believe in top down. We believe in bottom up. And so competition, iron sharpens iron. That's what makes us better leaders.
How important is it to you, Congressman, for President Trump, former President Trump, not to run again in order for Republicans to kind of reclaim that mantle, given the turnout, what recently was the vote in the previous two elections?
Well, I think we have to do some soul searching in our party and recognize that certain candidates for Congress underperformed other candidates. And what do those candidates look like? What were the features of those candidates? Again, we're the party of competition and choice. So I'm not one to say this candidate shouldn't run or the former president shouldn't run. I think there will be a robust competition. I do not believe there will be a coronation for the nomination. But I want to say this, too, about 2024. We're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. The crises that are facing us right now have not changed since Tuesday. Inflation continues to be a massive 40-year problem for our country. The crime problem is significant. That's why a lot of Republicans did well in places where you've got a crime problem. The border crisis is significant. The energy crisis, the attack on American energy independence, it continues to be a big problem. And the president's approval rating continues to be at 40%. So even while the American people didn't give a mandate to Republicans, they certainly didn't give a mandate to the Democrats when they gave Republicans control of the House. So it's dissatisfaction all the way around. And it means that Republicans and Democrats alike need to do a better job responding to the problems facing the American people. Republicans in the majority are going to be laser focused on this inflation crisis. And I want to say this to your audience in particular. No amount of Federal Reserve tightening is going to solve this inflation crisis. There is a supply side problem as much as there is a demand side or excess demand issue in the economy. And we need to produce and supply more American-made energy in this country to fix the supply side. We need to take off the table the threat of higher taxes and overregulation, which impedes business investment, impedes the repairs that need to take place in the supply chain. If we don't do that, we are not going to get out of this inflation spiral, and you're going to continue to see aggressive tightening that will disrupt the financial markets.
Congressman, you said it. We've got an approval rating for the president in the 40s. We've got inflation at a 40-year high. And still, this is the position that the Republican Party finds itself in. And most people think that speaks to the failure of this party not to secure a bigger majority in the House or any majority whatsoever in the Senate. You talked about soul searching. So can you be more specific about what that actually means? What do you think? And I'll go back to the question we started the conversation with. What went wrong? What needs to change? What does that soul searching actually involve?
Well, look, again, I'm an optimist. I think to say when you take the majority, what went wrong, I think you have to give a little bit of credit to the candidates, the excellent candidates who did win and who did beat incumbent Democrats. And look at those candidates. What was the characteristics of those candidates? Those candidates were optimistic. They believed in America. They were patriotic. They believed in free enterprise as the solution, not the problem. They recognized that the government and fiscal policies and policy errors are why we have this inflation crisis. And they have solutions, and they offered solutions in the form of the commitment to America to stop the overspending, to produce American energy again, to fund, not defund, the police, to make sure we have law and order in our country again, and to secure our southern border, and to say, look, we are a nation of immigrants, but we're also a nation of laws. And I think the candidates that had that positive message were the candidates, the one candidates that had a more divisive message, and were only about opposition as opposed to policy solutions, those candidates struggled. So I believe in a Republican Party that presents a positive message about free enterprise, freedom, liberty, limited government, and upward mobility. That's how we're going to win the majority for the years to come.
Congressman, we're going to have a longer conversation about your role on the House Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigation in the next couple of weeks, and I'm looking forward to that conversation. Andy Barr there, Republican from Kentucky. AMH joins us now from Bali with a special guest. Hey, Anne-Marie.
Thanks so much, John. The fact that this guest is with me does sound like things are looking hopeful for the joint communicate leaders we're going to sign off for. I'm joined now by the president's deputy national security advisor, Mike Pyle. Mike, thanks so much for joining me. You're the representative at the table, what they call in the G20 speak, the Sherpa. And the fact that you're here at 8:15 Bali night before the leaders sign off on it, it sounds like it's hopeful that all 20 leaders will sign this communique. How are you able to get Russia on board?
So I don't want to get ahead of our leaders. Obviously, they will speak collectively coming out of the summit. But I think we're constructive that there's going to be a statement from the G20 that accomplishes what the president set out as his priorities coming in. You know, number one, to rally the world to speak in strong language around Russia's war in Ukraine, to condemn Russia, to condemn the consequences of Russia's behavior in terms of its stresses on the global economy, but then also to present to the world an affirmative vision for what an action plan could look like to address those stresses, particularly on vulnerable countries in the emerging world.
How crucial was Xi Jinping in China to getting this communique over the finish line?
So I think, you know, what I would say is, you know, President Biden and his vision was very essential to getting this communique over the finish line. Again, one, you know, coming in and working hard to rally a broad stretch of the G20. I think what you'll see in the communique when it's released is that most of the G20 came together to strongly condemn Russia's war, to strongly condemn those actions and the consequences that's had for the global economy. And you're also going to see reflected in that a lot of the priorities that the president's articulated, whether it's the need for reform at the multilateral development banks like the World Bank, mm-hmm. whether that's the need to stand up an effort to be more prepared for future pandemics, whether that's an issue like debt relief, where, again, like what we saw in October, one country out of the 20 was isolated while the rest of the 19 stood up and said, this is something we need to do to help vulnerable countries. I think you're going to see those priorities in the communique, and I think that's a reflection of U.S. leadership.
We're hearing a growing chorus on the margins or out in the front about some actions the United States has taken. One, the Inflation Reduction Act, giving subsidies to American companies, but also the curbs on chips to China, where potentially a European company like ASML in the Netherlands might get caught in the crossfires between what the United States does not want to happen, been selling to China. How have you been able to deal with your allies in these two critical issues that are going to help the U.S. domestically and is going to hurt them?
So with respect to the IRA, I mean, I think the core point is we have a shared challenge globally around climate change. And we have heard from the rest of the world for years that the United States needs to take major action to address that risk, to address this problem that we all face. And this is historic action that has never been taken before in the United States at this scale.
Macron called it unfriendly, though.
Well, again, I would say with respect to what is the core global challenge that we face of climate change, this is historic action that will further the U.S.'s achievement of its climate goals, and the U.S. achieving its climate goals is essential to the world achieving its climate goals. The other thing I would say is, you know, the investments that we're making in clean energy, in electric vehicles, you know, really are investments that you can't make enough of. And we invite other countries to similarly make investments in their own clean energy sector, in their own secure battery supply chains. These are things that we think that we can do in a way that is going to serve everyone's interests. And the United States has taken a huge step forward to do that for our economy and for the rest of the world.
The president obviously came into this meeting with all these leaders with a pretty much a big boost in his step, in the sense that the Democrats are able to maintain control of the Senate, even though we still don't know what's going on with Georgia. And the red wave really was a red ripple. Do you think if that outcome was different, it would have changed the meetings and how the president was perceived here on the ground?
So I'm the economics guy, not the politics guy. But, you know,
but the world right now, the economy and politics are everything when a country's dealing with sky-high inflation and the likes.
I think that, as I said before, U.S. leadership, the president's leadership, was on full display. I think they see a U.S. economy that is resilient in the face of global challenges. They see a president and an administration that have delivered on their promises in terms of reinvesting in the U.S. economy, in terms of taking historic action on climate change. And I think as a result of that leadership, a lot of the things that I described as our agenda coming into this, the president's agenda coming into this, you know, really met with a lot of open ears and open arms from most of the G20.
Mike Pyle, thank you so much for joining me and Bloomberg Television. John, Lisa, that was President Biden's Deputy National Security Advisor, Mike Pyle. In the G20 speak, he is the Sherpa. He represents the U.S. interests at the table as they go through every single issue that they are going to sign off on this communique. And at the moment, it does look like they are going to get all or at least the majority of leaders on board.
MH, great work. Not just this morning, but over the last couple of days as well. I'm Marie Hordern there.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.